ticket for the circus?
Two, please. One for me and a half ticket for my little boy.
Little boy? Why, lady, put that giant down and let him carry you.
But he's only four.
25 cents more for the young man, lady.
But, oh, all right. There.
Thank you, madam. No matter how far we travel, no matter where we stop, it's always the same old story. Put the most honest woman in the world at a circus gate with a kid, and she'll try like a trooper to get him through for half fare. Circus commencing. This way to the circus.
Living 1949, brought to you each week by NBC and its affiliated stations, in the midst of summer living 1949, holds up its radio mirror to reflect for you...
Billowing tents, red and gold wagons, spangled kites, elephants, pink lemonade, tan bark, and cotton candy.
Yes, one of mankind's oldest and gayest institutions, the circus, in a drama document entitled...
Big Tough and Midway.
And now that master of the microphone, that daring young man who daily treads the invisible high wire of a nationwide network and lives to do it again, your narrator and circus lover, Ken Banghart.
America, greetings, fellow admirers of midgets, living skeletons, fat women, headhunters, sword swallowers, bearded ladies. Let's walk the tan bark line midway, past the ticket wagons, past the refreshment and novelty stands, the menagerie and sideshow into the magic land, and see how far we can trace the guy ropes. For believe me, the circus has a history and a story all its own. Our plan for this inviting journey is simple. We shall search the course of the circus in historical experience through the billboards, the posters, the gay, gaudy, splendiferous, word-heavy advertisements that have hailed the coming of circuses and all their wonders since they became a refreshment of civilization. We turn to the pages of The Circus from Rome to Ringling by Earl Chapin May, and we begin by taking you back 2,000 years to 50 B.C., to the Rome of Pompey and the Circus Maximus. Our first poster...
"5 days of performances in the Circus Maximus, free to all and everyone. Rain or shine, the sanguinary slaughter of 500 fierce Numidian lions, 20 ponderous pachyderms. Performances to be interspersed with chariot racing, plus equestrian and acrobatic feats of great daring and dexterity."
Yes, these were the actual words chalked on Rome's ancient walls, proclaiming the father of all circuses, the Circus Maximus, circus meaning circle, thus giving the word we all love a Latin origin. Sponsor of the circus, the great Roman general...
Gnaeus Pompeius Magnus.
Reason?
It seemed but a fitting and proper way to win the people to my rule. Therefore did I decree...
Adem et curtense!
Free bread and fun for all.
And exactly as he had decreed, at noon of the opening day, perhaps the first of all the glittering street parades to follow, wound its way through the jammed streets of the capital, past the Forum, to the huge Circus Maximus between the Palatine and Aventine Hills.
The streets and seven hills are crowded with cheering Romans, and what a parade they see.
Hail! Hail, Pompey the Great!
First of all, Pompey. Pompey in a toga of Tyrian purple. Pompey in a richly plated chariot drawn by 4 spirited horses. And before and after the ruler...
Look, the Antonians. The white-clad ones be the lictors carrying fasces.
The fasces denoting Roman law and dignity. Then...
And here, Antonians, come the centurions.
Centurions riding at the head of the marching companies. And behind, gold tableau wagons drawn by elephants bearing images of the gods and pompous family. Colleges of priests and other nobles. Horses and horsemen.
A sudden cheer from 150,000 Romans packed on unshaded tiers of stone and wooden seats greets the parade as it enters the Circus Maximus. Pompey takes his seat in a canopied gallery near the main entrance. Then, a white flag is tossed onto the sanded circular racecourse,
the trumpets blare, and the show begins.
What did we see at the Circus Maximus? Lions and elephants fighting to the death. Condemned criminals put in the ring with a charging lion. And armed only with a stylus, a pencil, their only chance for life, a well-aimed thrust. Desultories or equestrians leaping from bareback to bareback. In one show, they introduce...
A camelopard! He's a long neck and head!
A camelopard, a giraffe, all too quickly torn apart by the tigers. And races, races between tame elephants and African camels driven by dark-skinned Berbers, conquered in Carthaginia and advertised, not unlike today, as...
Imported at great expense of time and money!
The biggest feature of all, the chariot races.
By Jupiter, I wager thee 100 sesterces.
On the nose?
On the proboscis. Done.
15 races with 6 four-horse-drawn chariots lapping the circle 7 times as each driver tries to lock wheels and wreck his fellow contestants.
Saddest of all spectacles, however, are those that came as the circuses continue into the AD era. With a huge red and white canopy covering the arena for the event, and the air sprayed with perfume, patricians and plebeians hear the announcement.
Now, 1,000 Christians will be thrown to the lions in one day's entertainment!
Gone now was the grandeur that was Rome, but still men remember. Throughout the Dark Ages, animal trainers, riders, and acrobats wandered over Europe, sleeping in vans or under hedges, entertaining the people in local markets, or appearing by command before rulers. King Alfred saw...
This day, I saw me a wild beast show.
William the Conqueror brought from France to England...
Let the court be invited come sundown, that they may see my troop performing feats of great strength and agility.
Thus, through the centuries, is the spirit of the Circus Maximus kept alive. Comes now the 18th century, and the horse-riding son of an English cabinet maker, Sergeant Major Philip Astley. The year, 1770. The bill, posted in taverns and stores on fences and poles.
Activity on horseback by Mr. Astley, Sergeant Major in His Majesty's Royal Regiment of Light Dragoons. Nearly 20 different attitudes will be performed on 1, 2, and 3 horses every evening during the summer at his riding school. Doors to be open at 4, he will mount at 5. Seats, 1 shilling, standing places, 6.
Also regularly exhibited by the remarkable Mr. Astley...
At full speed, the different cuts and guards made use of by Elliot, the Prussian and Hessian hussars. Also, the manner of Elliot's charging the French troops in Germany in the year 1760, when it was said the regiment were all tailors.
And for comedy?
Billy Button, or The Tailor's Ride to Brentford.
Yes, featuring the apparently limitless Sergeant Major from the 15th King's Royal Regiment of Light Dragoons. So successful becomes his entertainment that his two-story wooden building called...
Astley's British Riding School...
soon became...
the Amphitheatre Riding School.
And when that burned down...
now under the patronage of the Prince of Wales and the Duke of York, the Royal Amphitheatre of Arts.
Small wonder that Philip Astley is known as the father of our 20th century circuses. The circus in America, the America that was 13 colonies, was born with John Bill Ricketts, one-time pupil of a competitor of Philip Astley. If you were walking along the streets of Philadelphia in 1793, you would not be surprised at a poster that announced...
They will leap over 10 horses at once. They will ride around the ring with a boy on his shoulders in the attitude of Mercury. He will leap from one horse through a hoop suspended in the air 12 feet to recover his situation, the horse being at full speed.
That was John Bill Ricketts, Ricketts the incomparable, circus rider to the people, and riding companion to none other than General George Washington. After the War of 1812, the American circus changed from the old-style European permanent circus into rolling shows, moving from village to village by horsepower, and performed in small pitch tents. These were the days of Rufus Welch, first of the American-born showmen. The Sells brothers, Ephraim, Allen, Lewis, and Peter. W.C. Coop, who originated performances in Two Rings. And Adam Forepaugh.
Adam Forepaugh. Let us pause here a moment to honor Adam Forepaugh, who bore not only the name of the first man, but also the reputation of holding the first American beauty contest. It all happened in 1880 when he announced...
$10,000 to the most beautiful American woman!
History is silent about how the nation received this bold announcement. All we know is that sooner or later, Adam announced...
The winner, Louise Montague!
And thereafter, she was featured in Forepaugh's circus parades as...
The $10,000 beauty!
This, then, was the American circus B.B. before Barnum. And now for some anecdotes from the career of the most fabulous of all circus figures. We thumb the pages of The Unknown Barnum by Harvey W. Root.
Mr. Barnum, what are your plans now, Mr. Barnum?
Yes, what are you going to do?
Going to give us another Tom Thumb?
Another Jenny Lind?
No, gentlemen, that's all in my past. I'm 60 years old now, and I'm ready to retire.
Mr. Barnum!
Yes. You can put it in your papers that I'm going back to my old hometown of Bridgeport to retire to... serious reflection on the ends and aims of human existence.
So spoke Phineas Taylor Barnum as he passed the age of 60. P.T., whose promotion successes had put his name on the tongues of the world. But like Sarah Bernhardt and all the others for whom retirement and farewell tours were chronic, a few years later, on April the 10th, 1871, in Brooklyn, New York, he began a new career with a bill proclaiming... And so, far from contemplating the ends and aims of human existence, Barnum began at 60 to devote the large remainder of his life to humanity's odds and ends, making the name of the Connecticut Yankee a household word to the ends of the earth. His first circus included...
A circus, a museum, a menagerie, a caravan, a hippodrome.
It required...
500 men and horses to handle and transport it.
The tents covered...
Nearly 3 acres of ground.
Capacity...
10,000 people crowded inside and 10,000 more outside desperate to get in.
With this show, Barnum toured the states from Maine to Kansas. Not content with his success, he returned to New York and sought financial backing to add new attractions. Pooh-poohed a bank president.
I'm sorry, Mr. Barnum. Circuses are a fad. In a year or two, they'll be finished.
Bunkum. As long as there are babies, there'll be circuses.
Barnum got the money and in 1873 showed up in London with...
Barnum's Great Museum, Menagerie, Circus, and Traveling World's Fair.
A year later, he was back in New York with...
Barnum! Roman Hippodrome! Featuring an anatomical representation of a convoluted nation, gold chariot, triumphal car, king, speed, emperor, in a rich and varied procession with all the happy, long banners, and the appropriate music saluting each nation.
It's debatable whether Barnum put elephants on the map or the elephants Barnum. In any case, two elephants loomed large in Barnum's life. The first was Hebe, and it was she that brought Barnum and Bailey together. The story goes something like this.
Did you read it, boss? Hebe's a mother. The first baby elephant born in captivity, and it's making Bailey a fortune in London.
Yes, I read it, and I don't like it, Sam. That baby rightfully belongs to me, and I intend to get it.
Well, it's nice, but how?
Take a telegram to James A. Bailey.
James A. Bailey.
Great London circus, Sanger's Royal British Menagerie, and Grand International Allied Shows. London, England.
Yes, sir.
Offer you $100,000 cash for Hebe's baby.
Bailey was a showman, too. He knew just what to do with a telegram like that. He plastered copies of it all over the billboards of London under the caption...
What Barnum thinks of the baby elephant!
Barnum met that challenge in typical Barnum style. He took Bailey into partnership, and soon the miniature pachyderm was mincing down Broadway under dual management, with crowds packing the sidewalk and even windows along the way for sale at
$10 a piece. Get a bird's eye view of Hebe's baby.
Elephant number two in Barnum's life was...
Jumbo! Jumbo, the biggest elephant in the world!
Yes, 6.5-ton, 11-foot-high Jumbo. Perhaps no animal that ever lived, and we're not borrowing circus jargon here, was ever as widely known as Jumbo. Under the glare of Barnum's publicity, he actually became an international character. It all began in 1882, when through confidential channels, Barnum...
Here... His name's Jumbo, Mr. Barnum. Maybe you've heard of him. He's living at the London Zoological Society Gardens. He's loved and pampered by all the children who ride around on his back.
Yeah? Go on.
Well, he's a giant, and he's still growing. And the story has it, the zoo is beginning to be afraid of him. You can't tell. He might like to get rid of him.
They will, when they've heard from me.
Barnum promptly offers the London Zoo $10,000 for Jumbo, an offer that is just as promptly taken up. But almost before the ink on the contract is dry, the storm breaks. A storm of protest so furious as actually to involve kings and ambassadors and threaten the peace between the two countries. Declares the New York Herald,
"It seems a sad thought that a war between England and America is imminent and may break out at any moment. The cause of this possible outbreak is the thought the sale of Jumbo, the pet elephant. Mr. Barnum vows that he will exhibit the giant to 40 millions of free Americans at 50 cents apiece. It seems a pity to rupture the amicable relations that have so long existed between us and our neighbors. But we must have that elephant."
Sighs our ambassador to England, James Russell Lowell.
"It seems that the only burning question between our two countries is Jumbo."
The argument reaches Parliament.
"When a southern slave owner put in force his legal right of separating a family at the auction block, the world rang with anathemas against the inhumanity of the deed. Surely, to tear this aged brute from a home to which he is attached is scarcely less cruel."
Crowds pour into the London gardens. The zoo directors are showered with abuse. And the editor of the London Telegraph sends a cablegram.
"Mr. P.T. Barnum, New York. Editor's compliments. All British children distressed at elephant's departure. Hundreds of correspondents beg us to inquire on what terms you will kindly return, Jumbo. Answer prepaid, unlimited."
Barnum replies,
"My compliments to Editor Daily Telegraph and British Nation. 50 millions of American citizens anxiously awaiting Jumbo's arrival. £100,000 would be no inducement to cancel the purchase. Wishing long life and prosperity to the British nation, the Daily Telegraph, and Jumbo, I am the public's obedient servant, P.T. Barnum."
Mournfully, the Daily Telegraph tells the British public,
"Jumbo's fate is sealed. The disappointing answer from his new American proprietor proves all too clearly that there is nothing to expect in the way of delicacy or remorse from that quarter. What will be the mental and physical condition of our immense friend when bereavement, seasickness, and American diet shall have ruined his temper and digestion? There'll be a Yankee twang in his trumpeting. He'll roll about on his sea legs with a gait sadly changed from the substantial swing so well known. Jumbo's mighty heart will probably break with rage, shame, and grief."
But Jumbo himself didn't read the Daily Telegraph. With elephantine poise, he stood the separation and the voyage well. On Easter morning, with 600 volunteers manning the ropes, Jumbo, crated, was hoisted onto American soil to become the chief attraction in Barnum's greatest show on earth. His appearance billed in the eternal posters,
"The most notable education event of the 19th century."
When he finally died, not from a broken heart, but from the impact of a Canadian locomotive, the stuffed Jumbo was presented to Tufts College in Massachusetts, and his skeleton to the American Museum of Natural History in New York. And P.T. Barnum, never at a loss, promptly advertised,
"Come and see her, Jumbo's grieving widow!"
Twice honored by his home city of Bridgeport by being elected mayor, president of its First National Bank, and leading citizen, it is said Barnum had but to give the word and the people would have sent him to Congress. Almost single-handed, Barnum ushered the circus into its golden age, an age that began in 1871 and didn't end until the First World War. It was an age resplendent with wonderful circus parades, golden wagons, white horses, fancy floats bringing the exotic outside world to the main streets of America. Prominent in it, as they are still prominent today, were the Ringling Brothers, who ultimately bought out Barnum and Bailey. and who began their rise to circus fame and fortune in 1885 with one of the most startling circus posters of all time.
Hideous hyena striata gigantium. The mammoth midnight marauding man-eating monstrosity. While the world sleeps, he sneaks stealthily under cover of darkness to the cemetery and with ghoulish glee robs the tomb. He leaves behind him a trail of blood, and the wails of the dying are music to his ear.
But out of this rich Barnum Golden Age period, perhaps no circus character was more outstanding, more beloved than Buffalo Bill Cody. Buffalo Bill won his nickname supplying the Kansas Pacific Railway with buffalo meat. So his show was organized on Western lines, featuring the Indians who had been his mortal foes, cowboys, and the famous Deadwood coach once used to carry mail and passengers across the wilderness. A show noisy with the muffled drum of hoofs, the crack and rumble of the coach, the cries of the Indians, the rattle of rifle and revolver shot, the moans of the wounded, the yips and hoorays of the victors as the stagecoach arrives safely home. This, plus...
The celebrated Miss Annie Oakley, woman at arms, the greatest sure shot in the world, who will now illustrate for you her dexterity in the use of firearms.
Bullseye!
Annie, who as she shot holes out of playing cards, won eternal survival for her name as meaning a free ticket or pass to a show identified by a punched hole.
Bullseye!
Of Buffalo Bill, history is ripe with stories, especially about the time he took his
Wild West and Congress of Rough Riders of the World
to London, to the England of Queen Victoria. One story has it that when told by one of Victoria's sons...
Colonel, my mother says she is planning to see your show. I think you might rightfully expect Her Majesty in the audience the night after next.
Buffalo Bill generously replied...
Prince, give my regards to your mother. Tell her I've heard of her.
And another story for which we're indebted to Andrew Freeman and to the late circus publicity agent Dexter Fellows, who described it in their book, This Way to the Big Show.
It seems when Buffalo Bill was in London during the Queen's Golden Jubilee, Victoria commanded two performances. At one of them, four crowned heads and the Prince of Wales, later Edward VII, rode in the famous Deadwood coach as the Indians chased it around the arena, firing on it. They were the kings of Belgium, Denmark, Saxony, and Greece. But when the coach was rescued by the cowboys, Prince of Wales is supposed to have said to Buffalo Bill...
Colonel, have you ever held four kings before?
And Buffalo Bill, not the least of whose accomplishments was poker, answered...
I've held four kings, Your Royal Highness, but never four kings and a joker.
This is the road over which we have come, America, to the summer spectacle we now look upon as strictly an American institution, and which we still call, with scarcely a howdy-do to Pompey in ancient Rome, the circus. Today, there are 20 circuses on tour throughout the country, but since 1919, none have rivaled in size the combined Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey. The changes have been many.
From a permanent show to a mobile unit, from horse-drawn to mechanized, from gas-lit to electrically lighted, the first so lighted charged expert mission to see the lights. One ring has become three. From a show whose smells and eats and equestrian riders were the main drawing cards, to one that's a production with such theater men as Norman Bill Geddes, who one season designed the poleless tent, and John Murray Anderson, who does the staging. The parade is gone, bowing perhaps to the auto-crowded streets. And from...
El Devil Diablo, looping the loop on his bicycle, the veritable half-chief of all hazardous exploits, the extreme and absolute limit of sensationalism, reach at last, beyond the tremendously terrible temerity and the illimitable, inimitable incapability of Diablo, no man may go.
From this, we are coming more and more to put the accent on...
60 smiling girls in 60 smiling moons. Theme song, I'm in love with a girl in the moon.
The modern American circus has been described as a mobile arsenal of amusements. Listen to this and you'll know why.
Ringling Circus travels about 15,000 miles each year, visits about 125 cities, employs over 1,400 people representing 28 countries. Daily overhead, $18,000. Plays to 3 or 4 million customers a season and takes in about $4 million. New tents are made every year, and the rope in single strand used in the tents would encircle the globe. The circus is powered by its own diesel plants, and when it moves, it uses 100 railway cars, 267 wagons, trucks, and cages.
Where it goes when is a major circus problem. As Freeman and Fellows put it,
routing a big circus is like maneuvering an army in time of war. The enemy is adverse economic conditions, and it's poor policy for the circus to tour the South before the cotton crop is picked, or to play in the Midwestern wheat belt before the harvest is started. A manufacturing community is usually good at any time of year if production is normal.
First item to leave winter headquarters early in March is the advance car, which all season stays in front of the circus by 3 weeks. Its job?
To see to just about everything. Community conditions, crops, weather, school terms, contracts for circus grounds, billboards, hay, straw, oats, shavings, tons of beef, and hundreds of loaves of bread. And, of course, bill posting.
Where circus areas overlap, bill posting wars have often taken place.
Look, all over the biggest barn in town. They beat us to it.
Oh, what are you worried about? Tear them down and put up odds.
Or?
When you get a chance, slip soap into their paste.
Soap in the paste makes the opposition posters stick until they leave town, then fall off. Getting a circus up is even a bigger job than getting it advertised. First to go up,
the cookhouse.
Then the main tent.
Way up over your head, boys.
With a 225-man canvas crew to help. And a bunch of wide-eyed kids enticed by a kid pusher with a remark like,
"Hey, Sonny, want to do a little work for a pass? See the show for nothing?"
The only permanence of the circus is its impermanence. And in a matter of hours after the last show, the whole business is torn down and packed on railway cars and off again to another stop. On an itinerary usually kept secret.
Say, what's this town anyway?
I don't know. Who cares?
And of course, there's that last wonderful feature no circus could do without.
Look, Daddy, here they come, the clowns!
One of the most famous clowns of all.
Joseph Grimaldi. I, Charles Dickens, helped edit his memoirs. Upon my word, it outsold Oliver Twist.
All circus clowns are today called...
Joeys.
After Joe Grimaldi. The aim of clowns, of course, is to create laughter. That traditionally, they often do this in spite of themselves, is best illustrated by this story.
Well, sir, I can see nothing wrong with you physically. As a matter of fact, you're in good shape.
But, Doctor, I'm sure something must be wrong. I'm always depressed.
Maybe you're working too hard. Then try some amusement. I tell you what, the circus is in town.
Now,
well, why don't you go see the fellow I saw last night? He's the greatest clown and pantomimist of all times. He'll make you laugh if anybody can. His name's George Fox.
Doctor.
Eh?
Got news for you. I am George Fox.
We give you then, America, that scintillating, kaleidoscopic, unparalleled, heterogeneous aggregation of multiplied wonders, the boon of our summers, the American Circus. Changed as it has through the years, it will doubtlessly endure as long as there is one man who can stand on his head and one other who will pay to see him. Or, as Barnum put it,
as long as there are babies, there'll be circuses.
In the words of Melvin Hildreth, past president of the Circus Fans of America,
the modern circus is truly an American institution, the one amusement that has never needed a censor. This summer, the circus will be new to thousands who see it for the first time. But new or old, it's always the circus. The circus creating the one common experience of joy found in all peoples in all lands everywhere, the smile.
Living 1949 is prepared and presented for the University of the Air by an NBC special program staff under the supervision of Wade Arnold. Lou Hazem writes the scripts. Your narrator today was Kenneth Banghart. Music is composed and conducted by Roy Shield. This program is directed by Jack Cuney. We invite you to keep abreast of Living 1949 by listening next week to our drama document entitled
Uncle Sam at the Doorbell.
This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.